Chapter 16. Beginning to respire freely again, and such another space of time would have cicatrized our wounds when, hark! A church bell rings out a loud alarm. The night is starlight and frosty. The iron notes are heard clear, solemn, but agitated. What could this mean? I hurried to a room over the porter's lodge, and, opening the window, I cried out to a man passing hastily below, "What, in God's name, is the meaning of this?" It was a watchman belonging to our district. I knew his voice, he knew mine, and he replied in great agitation, "It is another murder, sir, at the old town councillor's, Elburnus, and this time they have made a clear house of it. God preserve us! Has a curse been pronounced upon this city? What can be done? What are the magistrates going to do?" "I don't know, sir. I have orders to run to the Blackfriars, where another meeting is gathering. Shall I say you will attend, sir?" "Yes, no, stop a little. No matter, you may go on, I'll follow immediately." I went instantly to Maximilian's room. He was lying asleep on the sofa, at which I was not surprised, for there had been a severe stag chase in the morning. Even at this moment I found myself arrested by two objects, and I paused to survey them. One was Maximilian himself. A person so mysterious took precedency of other interests even at a time like this, and especially by his features, which, composed in profound sleep, as sometimes happens, assumed a new expression, which arrested me chiefly by awaking some confused remembrance of the same feature seen under other circumstances and in times long past. But where? This was what I could not recollect, though once before a thought of the same sort had crossed my mind. The other object of my interest was a miniature, which Maximilian was holding in his hand. He had gone to sleep apparently looking at this picture, and the hand which held it had slipped down upon the sofa, so that it was in danger of falling. I released the miniature from his hand, and surveyed it attentively. It represented a lady of sunny, oriental complexion, and features the most noble that it is possible to conceive. One might have imagined such a lady, with her raven locks and imperial eyes, to be the favorite sultana of some Amirat or Muhammad. What was she to Maximilian, or what had she been? For, by the tear which I had once seen him drop upon this miniature, when he believed himself unobserved, I conjectured that her dark tresses were already laid low, and her name among the list of vanished things. Probably she was his mother, for the dress was rich with pearls, and evidently that of a person in the highest rank of court beauties. I sighed as I thought of the stern melancholy of her son, if Maximilian were he, as connected, probably, with the fate and fortunes of this majestic beauty, somewhat haughty, perhaps, in the expression of her fine features, but still noble, generous, confiding. Laying the picture on the table, I awoke Maximilian, and told him of the dreadful news. He listened attentively, made no remark, but proposed that we should go together to the meeting of our quarter at the Blackfriars. He colored upon observing the miniature on the table, and, therefore, I frankly told him in what situation I had found it, and that I had taken the liberty of admiring it for a few moments. He pressed it tenderly to his lips, sighed heavily, and we walked away together. I pass over the frenzied state of feeling in which we found the meeting. Fear, or rather horror, did not promote harmony. Many quarreled with each other in discussing the suggestions brought forward, and Maximilian was the only person attended to. He proposed a nightly mounted patrol for every district. And in particular he offered, as being himself a member of the university, that the students should form themselves into a guard, and go out by rotation, to keep watch and ward from sunset to sunrise. Arrangements were made toward that object by the few people who retained possession of their senses, and for the present we separated. Never, in fact, did any event so keenly try the difference between man and man. Some started up into heroes under the excitement. Some, alas for the dignity of man, drooped into helpless imbecility. Women, in some cases, rose superior to men, but yet not so often as might have happened under a less mysterious danger. A woman is not unwomanly, because she confronts danger boldly. But I have remarked, with respect to female courage, that it requires, more than that of men, to be sustained by hope, and that it droops more certainly in the presence of a mysterious danger. The fancy of women is more active, if not stronger, and it influences more directly the physical nature. In this case, few were the women who made even a show of defying the danger. On the contrary, with them fear took the form of sadness, while with many of the men it took that of wrath. And how did the Russian guardsman conduct himself amidst this panic? Many were surprised at his behavior. Some complained of it. I did neither. He took a reasonable interest in each separate case, listened to the details with attention, and, in the examination of persons able to furnish evidence, never failed to suggest judicious questions. But still he manifested a coolness almost amounting to carelessness, which to many appeared revolting. But these people I desired to notice that all the other military students, who had been long in the army, felt exactly in the same way. In fact, the military service of Christendom, for the last 10 years, had been anything but a parade service, and to those, therefore, who were familiar with every form of horrid butchery, the mere outside horrors of death had lost much of their terror. In the recent murder there had not been much to call forth sympathy. The family consisted of 2 old bachelors, 2 sisters, and 1 grandniece. The niece was absent on a visit, and the 2 old men were cynical misers, to whom little personal interest attached. Still, in this case as in that of the wine shops, the same twofold mystery confounded the public mind: the mystery of the how, and the profounder mystery of the why. Here, again, no atom of property was taken, though both the misers had hordes of ducats and English guineas in the very room where they died. Their bias, again, though of an unpopular character, had rather availed to make them unknown than to make them hateful. In one point this case differed memorably from the other that, instead of falling helpless, or flying victims as the wine shops had done, these old men, strong, resolute, and not so much taken by surprise, left proofs that they had made a desperate defense. The furniture was partly smashed to pieces, and the other details furnished evidence still more revolting of the acharnment with which the struggle had been maintained. In fact, with them a surprise must have been impracticable, as they admitted nobody into their house on visiting terms. It was thought singular that from each of these domestic tragedies a benefit of the same sort should result to young persons standing in nearly the same relation. The girl who gave the alarm at the ball, with 2 little sisters, and a little orphan nephew, their cousin, divided the very large inheritance of the wine shops. And in this latter case the accumulated savings of 2 long lives all vested in the person of the amiable grandniece. But now, as if in mockery of all our anxious consultations and elaborate devices, 3 fresh murders took place on the 2 consecutive nights succeeding these new arrangements. And in one case, as nearly as time could be noted, the mounted patrol must have been within call at the very moment when the awful work was going on. I shall not dwell much upon them, but a few circumstances are too interesting to be passed over. The earliest case on the first of the 2 nights was that of a courier. He was 50 years old, not rich, but well off. His first wife was dead, and his daughters by her were married away from their father's house. He had married a second wife, but, having no children by her, and keeping no servants, it is probable that, but for an accident, no third person would have been in the house at the time when the murderers got admittance. About 7 o'clock, a wayfaring man, a journeyman courier, who, according to our German system, was now in his Wunderjahr, entered the city from the forest. At the gate he made some inquiries about the couriers and tanners of our town, and, agreeably to the information he received, made his way to this Mr. Heinberg. Mr. Hainberg refused to admit him until he mentioned his errand and pushed below the door a letter of recommendation from a Silesian correspondent, describing him as an excellent and steady workman. Wanting such a man, and satisfied by the answers returned, that he was what he represented himself, Mr. Hainberg unbolted his door and admitted him. Then, after slipping the bolt into its place, he bade him sit to the fire, brought him a glass of beer, conversed with him for 10 minutes, and said, "You had better stay here tonight. I'll tell you why afterwards. But now I'll step upstairs and ask my wife whether she can make up a bet for you, and do you mind the door while I'm away?" So saying, he went out of the room. Not 1 minute had he been gone, when there came a gentle knock at the door. It was raining heavily, and, being a stranger to the city, not dreaming that in any crowded town such a state of things could exist as really did in this, the young man, without hesitation, admitted the person knocking. He has declared since, but, perhaps, confounding the feelings gained from better knowledge with the feelings of the moment, that from the moment he drew the bolt he had a misgiving that he had done wrong. A man entered in a horseman's cloak, and so muffled up that the journeyman could discover none of his features. In a low tone the stranger said, "Where's Hainberg?" "Upstairs." "Call him down, then." The journeyman went to the door by which Mr. Hainberg had left him, and called, "Mr. Hainberg, here's one wanting you." Mr. Hainberg heard him, for the man could distinctly catch these words. "God bless me, has the man opened the door? Oh, the traitor. I see it." Upon this he felt more and more consternation, though not knowing why. Just then he heard a sound of feet behind him. On turning round, he beheld 3 more men in the room. One was fastening the outer door, one was drawing some arms from a cupboard, and 2 others were whispering together. He himself was disturbed and perplexed, and felt that all was not right. Such was his confusion, that either all the men's faces must have been muffled up, or at least he remembered nothing distinctly, but 1 fierce pair of eyes glaring upon him. Then, before he could look round, came a man from behind, and threw a sack over his head, which was drawn tight about his waist, so as to confine his arms, as well as to impede his hearing in part, and his voice altogether. He was then pushed into a room, but previously he had heard a rush upstairs, and words like those of a person exulting, and then a door closed. Once it opened, and he could distinguish the words, "In one voice, and for that." To which another voice replied, in tones that made his heart quake, "Aye, for that, sir." And then the same voice went on rapidly to say, "Oh dog! Could you hope at which word the door closed again?" Once he thought that he heard a scuffle, and he was sure that he heard the sound of feet, as if rushing from one corner of a room to another. But then all was hushed, and still for about 6 or 7 minutes, until a voice close to his ear said, "Now, wait quietly till some persons come in to release you. This will happen within 30 minutes. Accordingly, in less than that time, he again heard the sound of feet within the house, his own bandages were liberated, and he was brought to tell his story at the police office. Mr. Hainberg was found in his bedroom. He had died by strangulation, and the cord was still tightened about his neck. During the whole dreadful scene his youthful wife had been locked into a closet, where she heard or saw nothing. In the second case, the object of vengeance was again an elderly man. Of the ordinary family, all were absent at a country house, except the master and a female servant. She was a woman of courage, and blessed with the firmest nerves, so that she might have been relied on for reporting accurately everything seen or heard. But things took another course. The first warning that she had of the murderer's presence was from their steps and voices already in the hall. She heard her master run hastily into the hall, crying out, "Lord Jesus! Mary, Mary, save me!" The servant resolved to give what aid she could, seized a large poker, and was hurrying to his assistance, when she found that they had nailed up the door of communication at the head of the stairs. What passed after this, she could not tell, Therefore, when the impulse of intrepid fidelity had been balked, and she found that her own safety was provided for by means which made it impossible to aid a poor fellow creature who had just invoked her name, the generous-hearted creature was overcome by anguish of mind, and sank down on the stair, where she lay, unconscious of all that succeeded, until she found herself raised in the arms of a mob who had entered the house. And how came they to have entered? In a way characteristically dreadful. The night was starlit. The patrols had perambulated the street without noticing anything suspicious, when two foot passengers, who were following in their rear, observed a dark-colored stream traversing the causeway. One of them, at the same instant tracing the stream backward with his eyes, observed that it flowed from under the door of Mr. Munzer, and, dipping his finger in the trickling fluid, he held it up to the lamplight, yelling out at the moment, "Why, this is blood!" It was so, indeed, and it was yet warm. The other saw, heard, and like an arrow flew after the horse patrol, then in the act of turning the corner. One cry, full of meaning, was sufficient for ears full of expectation. The horseman pulled up, wheeled, and in another moment reined up at Mr. Munzer's door. The crowd, gathering like the drifting of snow, supplied implements which soon forced the chains of the door and all other obstacles. But the murderous party had escaped, and all traces of their persons had vanished, as usual. Rarely did any case occur without some peculiarity more or less interesting. In that which happened on the following night, making the fifth in the series, an impressive incident varied the monotony of horrors. In this case the parties aimed at were two elderly ladies, who conducted a female boarding school. None of the pupils had as yet returned to school from their vacation, but two sisters, young girls of 13 and 16, coming from a distance, had stayed at school throughout the Christmas holidays. It was the youngest of these who gave the only evidence of any value, and one which added a new feature of alarm to the existing panic. Thus it was that her testimony was given. On the day before the murder, she and her sister were sitting with the old ladies, in a room fronting to the street. The elder ladies were reading, the younger ones drawing. Louisa, the youngest, never had her ear inattentive to the slightest sound, and once it struck her that she heard the creaking of a foot upon the stairs. She said nothing, but, slipping out of the room, she ascertained that the two female servants were in the kitchen, and could not have been absent, that all the doors and windows, by which ingress was possible, were not only locked, but bolted and barred, a fact which excluded all possibility of invasion by means of false keys. Still she felt persuaded that she had heard the sound of a heavy foot upon the stairs. It was, however, daylight, and this gave her confidence, so that, without communicating her alarm to anybody, she found courage to traverse the house in every direction, and, as nothing was either seen or heard, she concluded that her ears had been too sensitively awake. Yet that night, as she lay in bed, dim terrors assailed her, especially because she considered that, in so large a house, some closet or other might have been overlooked, and, in particular, she did not remember to have examined one or two chests, in which a man could have lain concealed. Through the greater part of the night she lay awake, but as one of the town clocks struck four, she dismissed her anxieties, and fell asleep. The next day, wearied with this unusual watching, she proposed to her sister that they should go to bed earlier than usual. This they did, and, on their way upstairs, Louisa happened to think suddenly of a heavy cloak, which would improve the coverings of her bed against the severity of the night. The cloak was hanging up in a closet within a closet, both leading off from a large room used as the young lady's dancing school. These closets she had examined on the previous day, and therefore she felt no particular alarm at this moment. The cloak was the first article which met her sight. It was suspended from a hook in the wall, and close to the door. She took it down, but, in doing so, exposed part of the wall, and of the floor, which its folds had previously concealed. Turning away hastily, the chances were that she had gone without making any discovery. In the act of turning, however, her light fell brightly on a man's foot and leg. Matchless was her presence of mind. Having previously been humming an air, she continued to do so. But now came the trial. Her sister was bending her steps to the same closet. If she suffered her to do so, Lottchen would stumble on the same discovery, and expire of fright. On the other hand, if she gave her a hint, Lottchen would either fail to understand her, or, gaining but a glimpse of her meaning, would shriek aloud, or by some equally decisive expression convey the fatal news to the assassin, that he had been discovered. In this torturing dilemma, fear prompted an expedient, which to Lottchen appeared madness, and to Luia herself the act of a Sibyl instinct. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.